Last week, we discussed the opening of the 69th Cannes Film Festival, and this week, we have plenty more from the French Riviera. My poor colleague Ben Ryland has been in Cannes this week to soak up the atmosphere and a little bit of sun too, I'm sure, but hopefully not too much, as he'll be reviewing for us three films he saw at the festival. And those films are a coming-of-age teenage road trip in the form of American Honey, Jeff Nichols' biopic of an interracial couple in mid-20th century Virginia called Loving, and one of this summer's blockbusters, Steven Spielberg's The BFG. That's all to come right here on the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeBias. Ben, welcome back to London. How was your trip to Cannes?
It was absolutely beautiful, Gillian. Look, I had to have a bit of an adjustment period when I first arrived because I quite literally walked onto a plane in the beautiful blue skies and sunshine of Nice and then came off the plane and it was miserable and grey and wet here in London. It was as though London had switched on its London best just to rub it in.
And it is also coming down from the circus that is Cannes.
Oh, it is indeed. And that's the perfect descriptor for it. It is an absolute circus. The festival itself, just to give you an idea, is just absolutely enormous. And just that, the little tidbits that we get in the most of the press that we see coming out of Cannes.
Just scratch the surface.
Exactly. I mean, the stars walking across the red carpet and the official selection that we hear so much about, that is really just a pebble in what is an enormous ocean of the film industry that we're talking about here. Just about every country that you can imagine has some sort of representation there. And the number of distributors who are there to try and market themselves to the filmmakers who are in the Marquee du Film, which are, of course, in itself marketing themselves to the distributors. I mean, that is what the festival is all about. And that is like, it's an absolute endless sea.
Well, we look forward to more reports from Cannes from you. But for now, we're going to hone our focus on three films in particular. Let's start with the first film. This is American Honey. It's by British director Andrea Arnold, known for the 2009 drama Fish Tank, and Oscar winner for her short film Wasp. This is the first time Arnold has shot a film outside of the UK, and it follows a teenage girl who ups and leaves home to join a travelling magazine sales crew on a Midwest road trip. Now, Ben, can you colour in the story for us just a little more?
We start off with the main character here, who is played by the newcomer Sasha Lane. Now, she is hitchhiking on a road with some two younger children in the first shot of the film. And there's really, I mean, if you haven't read the synopsis beforehand, you're really not entirely sure where this is going to be taking place because it is quite, it's quite an esoteric start to a film. But what is clear is that we are in middle America in one of those very hopeless small towns that you kind of want to drive straight through. There's really no reason to stop. It's filled with strip malls. It's filled with fast food joints, Walmarts, big box retailers. Not the kind of place that really puts America in its best light. Her lifestyle is, well, it's fairly hopeless. There's not a lot to it. She's been charged with looking after these two young children, and it seems they are not her children, but her younger siblings, and her mother is perhaps even more hopeless than the situation that she has put herself in. She decides, without any warning whatsoever, seemingly, after a chance encounter with a character played by Shia LaBeouf, that she's going to just drop everything and escape it all. And from there, that's where this road movie of sorts really starts and it switches into gear.
Road movies, success or failure, often depend on the ensemble cast. What is the casting like on this and how well do they perform together?
Importantly, it would be easy to pick up on Shia LaBeouf being in this film and really promoted that way. And that's not how the film is coming across whatsoever. The fact that Shia is in the film at all seems almost accidental. He's very, very affecting in his role. However, he's really not the star of the show at all. It is Sasha Lane who carries this film. The rest of the cast are also very competent. There's no weak link in this cast at all, but it really is Sasha's film, and she carries it very, very competently. The film... It is. I mean, it goes for a very long time. We're talking a low-key drama here that goes for nearly 3 hours. Now, that is a massive commitment, and it would be easy to accuse it of being perhaps a little bit too flabby. There are quite a few scenes here with wind blowing through the hair, with sort
nature,
of musical montages.
Like shots of wasps.
Exactly. Yeah, there are quite a few of those. And sometimes, as I was sitting there in the cinema, I mean, look, admittedly, I had seen maybe 14 films up until that point as well, and had maybe had 3 hours sleep. So that might have been affecting it somewhat. But it was easy to look at that and think, well, couldn't we have cut off a couple of these and compressed it a little bit? That said, if you were to ask me to sit through the film and choose which parts we could do without, I would have a very difficult time, because there is nothing in this film that doesn't add to the experience. It's a little bit reminiscent of a Sofia Coppola film, in that it does paint this very emotive picture that really it communicates its mood so well that you can't help but be taken by it.
And is that partly the cinematography? The cinematographer, I gather, has two films in Cannes, this one and Ken Loach's film.
Precisely, and that is a very, very major aspect of it. I think the main part of it, though, is all of it has to come together in order for it to affect you the way that this film does. So you need to have a brilliant cast the way that this film does. You need to have locations that are chosen so perfectly as well. I mean, there's one point where there's quite an emotive scene that takes place in a car at an oil field, and that it's happening at night, so really all you can see out the windscreen in front of the two characters is the burning oil field with this big flame that's making this this massive noise that almost drowns out what they're saying. And it's a very low-key scene, but it really it adds to the mood of the film so well, and then progresses onwards as well. It's those sorts of wise choices that really carry this film, and it's getting an amazing reception. There are a lot of predictions that this might be a contender for the Palme d'Or.
Well, we'll have to wait and see. The winner of the Palme d'Or will be announced this Sunday in Cannes. Another contender for the prize is Loving. This is a picture by Jeff Nichols, who's probably best known for this year's sci-fi adventure Midnight Special. Loving, however, is a rather different film, looking at a landmark interracial relationship in the 1950s Virginia. Ben, tell us a little more about this one, starting perhaps with the relevance of the title.
That's right. So Loving is, well, it means two things in this, really, because what we are looking at here is the story of a couple in 1958 Virginia. And their names are Richard and Mildred Loving. That's their name.
Go figure.
Essentially, however, what we're looking at is a story that's simply about two people that love each other. And that is the core of this story, and that's what carries it all the way through, because for whatever reason, the state of Virginia back in 1958 had determined that interracial marriage was illegal and something that needed to be punished. It needed to be punished and prosecuted so severely to the point where the police performed a raid on the house of Richard and Mildred Loving in the middle of the night, ripped them from their beds and put them both in jail, separate cells, and they were then, I mean, we're not giving anything away in the story by then saying that they were ostracized from the state and told that they could not come back for 25 years unless they divorced. It's a horrendous story. It's a true story, obviously. And I do have to admit that this is it's a wonderfully affecting film. The two leads here are key to the film's dramatic success. Ruth Negger is brilliant in her portrayal of Mildred, and Joel Edgerton, the Australian actor, absolutely tremendously subtle performance from him. I can't praise his performance in this highly enough.
Well, let's have a listen to their performances. Here is a clip from Loving.
I'm gonna build you a house right here. Our house.
Yes.
Would you marry me?
Loving, directed by Jeff Nichols, and one of the films in competition at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Now, amazing that this story is not more known, but I gather it was the topic of a documentary about 4 years ago.
Well, I suppose it isn't really known a lot because we have, we do have a lot of other stories that carry the weight of being those sorts of stories that progressed civil rights onwards. I'm thinking of things like Selma. There are stories that we do know. And this one is perhaps a little bit lower key, perhaps because, and this is maybe the only aspect of the film that weakens it a little bit for me, it's not the most dramatic picture in the world. So what happened to them was a very terrible thing, and without doubt would have been an abhorrent sort of situation to have to be in. But that said, progressing through that conflict in the story, the film doesn't really leave you with a huge dramatic punch. Perhaps that is why we're not more familiar with this story. I think the power in this film comes from the two leads and their performances. As I said, Joel Edgerton, absolutely fantastic in that scene. And obviously we heard that clip just then. You didn't hear a lot of his voice because his character is the kind of
silent.
Yeah, he's very insular. So and that's more to the power of Joel Edgerton because it would be quite difficult to communicate the sort of emotions that a character like that is feeling when he is left to say quite relatively few words in the film. He communicates the emotions through the expressions on his face when he's confronted by the police, and you can see his body language change and his shoulders sort of they start to crouch inwards and he can't make eye contact. There are all these really tiny subtleties that you can watch in every scene that he's floating through depending on who he's dealing with, and I think that is the power of the film.
So far, only American release dates have been announced for Loving, but look out for it in the US from November 4th. Finally, we're going to finish with the latest interpretation of Roald Dahl's classic children's story, The BFG. The book was first turned into an animated film in 1989, but now it's been placed in the hands of Steven Spielberg, who's brought it to life in a blend of live action and computer animation. Let's hear a clip first.
What kind of a monster are you?
Bone cruncher. Child chewer. Meat dripper. Gizzard gulper. Butcher boy.
Please don't eat me.
You think because I'm a giant that I'm a man-goblin cannibal?
A clip from Steven Spielberg's The BFG. Ben, was Spielberg the right director for this story?
Well, look, he's done a competent job. I'll give him that. The film looks wonderful. It will please many, many, many people. I think fans of Roald Dahl and the original text might look at this and think maybe there are a few elements missing, especially if you're a fan of some of the other adaptations of Roald Dahl. I'm thinking primarily of The Witches, which did a tremendous job at communicating the darkness behind the Roald Dahl take on the story. Steven Spielberg has always struck me as a director who are obviously one of the most accomplished directors of all time. However, he's not very fond of truly dark tales. If you watch a Spielberg film, there's always some sort of Spielbergian sheen over the top of the source material. I think that's what we're seeing here. As I came out of this film, I had myself thinking, imagine if someone like Tim Burton had have directed this film. Mm. And I mean, look, what we're dealing with here is a story about giants who seem to walk around London in the dead of night, snatching children from their beds, orphans, no less. I mean, this
and
is a
eating
terribly
them.
Eating them. Eating them. In the first few minutes of the film, we see a young girl snatched from her bed by quite a creepy-looking old man giant in the palm of his hand. Next thing, she's in a frying pan, jumping all over the place. It is a dark story, you know. However, Spielberg does not really exploit that aspect of the story at all. He plays up very heavily on the friendship that burgeons between these two characters, which is it's very well done. Mark Rylance in the role of the giant, a completely CGI giant. However, it was obviously based on Mark Rylance's performance. he does
CGI,
a tremendous
but his
job.
Face is his
it's definitely
face
his face
distorted, like so recognizably
yes.
human.
You can tell that it's his face, however everything else about his body is completely changed. He's got this small peanut like head that seems to stretch out on this bridge of a neck. It's quite a vision. And then you've got the other giants as well. So Mark Rylance as the BFG is obviously the junior giant. The other giants are much, much larger. The story itself, I mean, look, obviously most of us will probably be familiar with this story. It goes into quite ridiculous territory. We end up at Buckingham Palace. And all of that is treated quite nicely, especially considering Spielberg, being an American, might not quite grasp the very, very British nature of this story. So that aspect is done very well. This film is not playing in competition, so mm-hmm. obviously it's not a contender for the Palme d'Or. I don't think it would be anyway. But look, it does. It has some wonderful moments. It features some very delightful words like snozcumber and frobscottle. it will please many. It perhaps isn't the most sophisticated children's film of all time.
Well, the BFG will begin rolling out in cinemas around the world from the end of June, and it reaches America on July 1st and the UK on the 22nd of July. And just finally, Ben, the cinema show airs tonight at 20:00 hours London time. What can we expect to hear from Cannes on that?
Well, we will be featuring some more in-depth reviews of the titles that we've discussed today. We'll also be having a chat to a lot of the people on site over in Cannes. I was lucky enough to run into quite a few people who were telling me about how the festival works. As I was mentioning a little earlier in the show, at its core, Cannes is a trade show. It's an industry event, and it's a lot more than the red carpets and the big-time celebrities. So we'll be venturing far beyond that to talk to some of the people who are there, hoping to get their films signed to a distributor. I'll be chatting to a couple of South African filmmakers who are very accomplished in their own film markets and are at Cannes this year, hoping to get their film signed to a larger worldwide distribution deal. And we'll also be reviewing Pedro Almodovar's new film, Julieta, which of course is in competition. A lot of people saying that that might be the one to take away the Palme d'Or. I don't want to throw my prediction out there too much. I think American Honey is looking pretty good at the moment, though.
We shall wait and see. Ben, thanks so much for joining us on today's Arts Review. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeBias. The show was produced by Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time on Monday when we'll be talking art. But for now, goodbye from me. Have a great weekend. And